Hey, it's Jen. Just a quick heads up before we start the show. The news is rapidly developing, and things may have changed by the time you hear this episode. For the latest news, tune into your public radio station and follow updates at npr.org.
This is 1A. I'm David Gura in Washington, in for Jen White, and you're listening to the Friday News Roundup. Hundreds gathered across America to protest and mourn after eight people were killed in Atlanta this week. Six of those eight victims were women of Asian descent.
It's heartbreaking to notice and realize that time after time, similar issues happen. And it's as if we're never heard. It's as if the government doesn't care.
For many cities, the demonstrations are just a continuation of rallies that have been going on for months as Asian Americans protest a wave of anti-Asian violence. The tracking project Stop AAPI Hate says it's received nearly 3,800 complaints of harassment and violence in the past year. We'll get to the latest on the SPA shootings. Plus, the Biden administration faces pushback on both a rescue package and its plans for the U.S.-Mexico border. Here to talk about it, we have Shane Harris. He covers national security and intelligence for The Washington Post. Shane, it's always a pleasure.
Hey, David. Good to be here. Thanks.
And Alexis Simmendinger is a national correspondent for The Hill. Hey there, Alexis. It's great to have you with us.
Hey, David.
Well, let's start with Atlanta, as I said. And police have arrested and charged a 21-year-old white man for the murders of eight people in that city. The shootings took place at three spas in the greater Atlanta area. Shane, I want to start with the victims. We have most of the names of those victims now. What do we know at this point about who they were?
Well, we know some of these people were apparently employees of some of these spas, as well as people who were customers. There was a couple that was there having what they described as a date night and were there for a couple's massage. The woman sadly was killed. Her husband has survived. These were ordinary people that appeared to be, you know, either regular customers of these places or people who were working there who obviously had no expectation that they would be targeted in this way when they showed up for work. And as so often is the case in some of these stories we hear is they are in some ways just like ordinary folks, just like the rest of us who were, I think, some of them either trying to work a job or there for some kind of break for a little vacation for themselves, maybe a little respite. And obviously it turned into a tragic nightmare.
Shane, investigators and journalists are piecing together what happened on that day, and officers were able to track down that shooter pretty quickly as he made his way down I-75 in Atlanta. How was he caught?
Yeah, this is actually quite a testament to the technology and the speed with which I think police can get the word out on social media. When police responded to a 911 call at the first site, where the first shootings occurred at one of the establishments, they were able to get surveillance camera footage pointed out into the parking lot where the suspect had been parked for an hour. And then they were able to get a description of him and his car out pretty quickly on social media. The suspect then, his parents, actually Robert Aaron Long's parents, called police and said, "We think this might be our son." They were able to interview the parents, get more information, and the parents let them know, by the way, he has a cell phone and the tracking function on the phone is enabled, which allowed police to then eventually catch up with him after he had committed allegedly two more shootings, but eventually to find him speeding on the interstate south of Atlanta down to Florida, where authorities believe he was preparing to carry out more shootings.
There was a news conference that followed that arrest, and a spokesman for the sheriff's office in Cherokee County got into some hot water for what he said.
He was pretty much fed up and kind of at the end of his rope, and yesterday was a really bad day for him, and this is what he did.
Really bad day for him, and this is what he did. Alexis, the context, so crucial here. As I mentioned, we've seen a dramatic increase of violent attacks on Asian Americans, and in tandem with that, rates of domestic violence against women in this country have skyrocketed. All of this makes what the sheriff said there so problematic.
It does, and it was immediately a trigger for many, many advocates on behalf of Asian Americans to recoil at that comment. There was also, in addition, some controversy about what FBI Director Christopher Wray said, where he commented yesterday to NPR, "It does not appear that the motive was racially motivated." These kinds of comments and the combination of the federal comment and the local police really agitated those who believe and have argued that the federal government and local governments are not paying attention, are not giving the attention that's needed to the bigotry, the violence that has been focused on Asian Americans. And the argument has been that in the last year, not only have the statistics risen, but also were directly agitated by former President Trump, whose comments at the outset of the pandemic, they believe, really tried to dial up the bigotry against Asians, or the president's effort to try to call this the Wuhan virus or the Kung Fu flu. And so we saw some of that bubble up on Capitol Hill this week when there was a hearing already scheduled and the emotions ran very high.
The shooter has not yet been charged with a hate crime. Georgia has a new hate crimes law, hasn't been tested. Shane, help us understand the deliberation that's taking place here. Alexis, just a moment ago, referencing this interview that NPR's Kerry Johnson did with the FBI director yesterday. He said the FBI right now is in a supporting role to local law enforcement there in Georgia. We're talking about the potential here for this being prosecuted as a local, a state hate crime, principally, and the federal government, I suppose, could prosecute on its own behalf as well.
Yeah, the federal government can step in under certain circumstances. For instance, if they feel that there is a civil rights violation that was committed here. And a great deal of that, in fact, may depend on the motive of the shooter. And at this point, you know, he has said that he didn't have racism as a motive. But that's about all we know from his perspective. And that, by the way, is coming through police officers who I think to some degree are getting a bit ahead of the facts here in trying to somehow say what this wasn't, as opposed to trying to determine what really happened. If the Bureau, though, if the FBI does feel that there is a federal case to be made, as you said, they can step in and effectively prosecute this at the federal level. I think it's a little bit too early for that. Director Wray's comments may be a bit premature, but would also sort of signal that maybe on the at least the initial read here, the FBI might be inclined and Justice might be declined to think that the state of Georgia has the laws that they need, particularly maybe this hate crime law, to prosecute on their own.
Alexis, I mentioned the numbers at the top, the number of threats and attacks against Asian Americans in this country over the last year. I called that a surge of violence just a moment ago. These numbers are startling. What do we know about what's happening here?
Well, it's an interesting and a complex situation because almost all states have hate crimes laws, but not all states actually record the information about attacks or complaints in a way that's accessible. So those that do have suggested, and advocacy groups have suggested, these numbers have really gone up in the last year. And one of the things that we're watching in Washington is to what extent the politics that we're engaged in and we've seen here have contributed to the increase in these numbers during the pandemic, the concern that the coronavirus came originally from Wuhan in China. But those who are really watching these numbers, advocacy groups for Asian Americans, are trying to describe how spotty some of the information is and how there have been cases, prominent cases, in which the local jurisdictions have declined to use hate crime laws in order to prosecute. And obviously, these advocacy groups are interested in the hate crime law because it adds a measure of severity to sentencing if the perpetrators are found guilty. So there's some discussion in relationship to the surge and the numbers about what can be done about this. And certain groups who are welcoming the idea of hate crimes laws are also talking about the need for maybe better recording or information, and also the problem within the Asian American community that not all those who are the victims of crime want to come forward, and there are many, many reasons why they don't.
Shane, about the federal response more broadly, there was a hearing on Capitol Hill yesterday that had been scheduled before this attack took place. A gentleman from Texas, Chip Roy, the congressman, made some comments there that sort of took up a lot of the oxygen in the room during the course of that hearing. What has Congress said? What could Congress do? And I should note here, the president, the vice president, heading to Atlanta today, scheduled to address this issue on the ground in the state where this took place.
Yeah, and the debate in Congress, and you mentioned the congressman from Texas, seems to have divided. On the one hand, I mean, very broadly speaking, there are those more on the Democratic side of the aisle who want to talk about this surge in violence and want to talk about whether there's a federal role, whether there be some kind of legislation, or just devoting more resources potentially to the federal government to be able to track this, to isolate the problem more, to describe it better. Is there something the federal government could do there, and the Congress would play a role? And also the Congress plays a role on holding hearings like this one that were scheduled to try and elevate and draw more attention to this discussion. You know, I'm reminded of after the 9/11 attacks, how, you know, very notably President Bush at the time came out very quickly after 9/11 and said, you know, Americans need to understand that while, you know, the people who committed these acts appear to be have come from the Middle East and are of Arab descent, this is not an excuse to take it out on Arab Americans, and made that a huge part of his policy at the outset. You didn't see that from the previous administration. Instead, what you're now hearing from a lot of the arguments on the Republican side is that what the Democrats are up to here is some kind of effort to police free speech or to stop people from, you know, that they're somehow trying to be thought police. It's a bit of a tortured argument. The congressman from Texas had some colorful imagery that seemed to connote lynching and mob justice, and that was what was called for, perhaps, in this case. It's a pretty muddled message, to say the least, but I think that what Democrats are trying to do is at least rhetorically put a spotlight on this issue. And even if it turns out that, you know, racism was not a primary motive in this shooting, it has clearly drawn attention to an area that is unresolved and still painful for many Americans.
We are rounding up the week's top news. We'll have more from you and our guests in a moment.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Integrative Therapeutics. For over 35 years, their focus has been on manufacturing high-quality supplements such as Cortisol Manager and Adrenal Complex, produced with premium ingredients designed by clinicians and based on established ingredient research. Committed to helping people feel confident as they navigate their health journey. Integrative Therapeutics, because confidence is healthy.
On NPR's Consider This podcast, we don't just help you keep up with the news, we help you make sense of what's happening. Like what the case about George Floyd's killing means for the ongoing fight for racial justice, or how to best navigate a pandemic that's changed life for all of us. All of that in 15 minutes every weekday. Listen now to Consider This from NPR.
It's the News Roundup. We're discussing the biggest headlines this week. Well, the Biden administration is responding to the surge of migrants, many of them children, entering the United States through our border with Mexico. Over 4,000 children are in Border Patrol custody as of this week. The head of the Department of Homeland Security predicting more people will be detained at the border this year than have been detained in the past two decades. Here's what President Biden had to say during an interview this week with ABC News.
I can say quite clearly, don't come. And what we're in the process of getting set up, and it's not going to take a whole long time, is to be able to apply for asylum in place. So don't leave your town or city or community. We're going to make sure we have facilities in those cities and towns run by DHS and also accessed with HHS, the Health and Human Services, to say you can apply for asylum from where you are right now. Make your case. We'll have people there to determine whether or not you are able to meet the requirement you qualify for asylum. That's the best way to do this.
Shane Harris, I'll turn to you first. And during the campaign, this was a point of real contrast between the two candidates, what was going to be the policy changes that take place at the U.S.-Mexico border. What's happening? What's caused the surge that we're seeing?
I think there are probably a number of circumstances driving this. One is seasonal. You do tend to see an uptick in people coming across the border as the weather gets warmer because the traveling is easier. I imagine there is also a perception on the part of people coming across that the current administration is going to be more accommodating to people who are trying to come over and will not face some of the more draconian measures they did before, you know, including the separation of families. And we all remember the images of children held in these kind of makeshift cages and detention facilities. There's part of that. There's also what's been driving them all along. In addition to the desire for a better life, it's to flee some pretty dire circumstances in their countries where they might be facing persecution, poverty. And that hasn't changed just because there's a new president from a different party in the White House. So this is all kind of converging. The nature of the problem is the same. And what you're seeing here, I think, is the Biden administration kind of having to improvise a response along the way. And I just thought it was very notable that you had this image of the president basically saying to people, like, stop, don't come. That kind of gives you a sense of the triage that I think that they're in right now.
Alexis, in Politico, reporters pointing out the efforts the administration is going to not to call this a crisis. The Biden administration doesn't want to call this a crisis yet. From the numbers that I've cited, though, it seems like we're heading that direction if we're not there yet.
Well, the semantics are of concern inside the administration, because what we're watching is a president who has been eager to spend this time this week talking about the success of getting $1.9 trillion in coronavirus relief through Congress and then finds himself, as all presidents do, eventually getting sidetracked on other things. We know he's going to Georgia. He thought he was going to be talking about politics in Georgia tonight, and instead he's going to be talking about the violence against Asian Americans and what happened in the Atlanta area. So all presidents do get sidetracked, but what's happening at the border is a major issue politically for the Democratic Party, because the president and his leadership understand very, very well that Republicans are already campaigning and fundraising off of this, are on the sidelines describing this as a crisis of Biden's making, trying to argue to voters in the electorate, especially in the suburbs, that this is an issue they need to pay attention to for 2022, and that this new administration is really botching its response, and really squeezing the president, who basically even asked the courts for a 100-day moratorium to try to figure out what policy the administration wanted to put in place after initially, after his inauguration, rescinding some of the Trump policies. And you can see that the president's rhetoric, President Biden's rhetoric, is evolving, and even his leadership advisor on the border was telling reporters this week that they were going to need to have to do a better job. They're going to try to do advertising and reach into those countries that Shane just identified, El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala, that are most responsible for sending these migrants through Mexico. And then, of course, what did we learn this week, yesterday, just to add, the Biden administration is reaching a deal with Mexico, dealing with a swap of AstraZeneca COVID vaccine that Mexico desperately wants, arguing that this is not a quid pro quo, but also at the same time trying to figure out if Mexico will hold and deal with this amnesty and the immigration elements and try to hold back the migrants, which is similar to what President Trump tried to do in 2019.
And one of our listeners, David, picking up on the need for that kind of cooperation and collaboration, writing on Facebook, quote, "If slowing the flow of migrants is truly the goal, border security isn't the answer. Working with the countries they're coming from to fix the issues which are causing migration, many of which we cause through our imperialism," he writes, "is the long-term answer." Another listener, Ray, writing in, "This is on Biden. Stop the talk of blaming anything else. He campaigned on it. Now it is on his lap." Let me pick up on that with Shane. We had the Republican leader in the House down at the border this week. This is a humanitarian issue. It is a policy issue, Shane. It is also a political issue.
Yeah, and Kevin McCarthy down at the border, not letting a crisis go to waste here, use this as an opportunity, you know, to say, look, the influx in border crossings is because the Biden administration has rolled back policies from the Trump administration, and specifically halting construction on the border wall. That seems a pretty, a bit of a tendentious statement, a bit of a leap to say, considering the administration is only 2 months old at this point. But as Alexis pointed out, I mean, the political stakes of this are obvious, and the Republicans, of course, are going to use this the same way, frankly, that Democrats did when the President Trump and Republicans were driving the policy. But, you know, if immigration reform and border security were an easy fix that had an obvious bipartisan answer, we'd have it by now. And it doesn't. And a big reason for that also, too, is because within the parties, and particularly within the Republican Party, there's not unanimity on what the solution ought to be. It's a years-long process. And what we're seeing here is that people who want a better life aren't waiting for the politicians to figure it out. They're going to try and come because they feel that their circumstances are desperate enough to take that risk.
NBC News reported that the Biden administration has asked Border Patrol agents not to share certain information with journalists, including photos from detention centers and data on how many migrants are in custody. Officials are at the border telling NBC News that these restrictions were not official orders. Alexis, Shane, just a moment ago, mentioning those searing images from the last administration of children in cages, they became something that fueled the conversation surrounding immigration policy in this country. There is now a lot of concern about one detention center in particular, recently opened in Donna, Texas, reportedly overcrowded with migrant children. Members of the media have not been allowed in to see it. What is Customs and Border Protection, what's the Department of Homeland Security saying about that facility in particular, Alexis, and why have reporters been shut out of it?
Well, there's a complicated set of facts, I think, that have to do with politics and optics, but also an effort on the part of the administration to say that these young people are minors, that they don't want them to be, you know, photographed, exploited. The administration is saying that they're providing the data, that they're trying to be transparent about the data and the efforts to try to remedy some of the complications. They, of course, are allowing advocates on the part of the children from organizations, and those advocates do come out and talk to journalists. Journalists have gone to the border. I'm thinking of the New York Times, for instance, that sent a team to the border and came away with some very vivid optics from asylum seekers and families, not necessarily just children. So the administration is, as I was saying earlier, is really in a squeeze to try to race to try to remedy some of the problems before the optics, whether they're photographs or, you know, any quotes from those who are inside the Customs and Border Protection or HHS get a chance to talk to reporters to see if they can remedy and resolve some of the situations. The data, though, that's coming out suggests that they have a long way to go because the numbers are so enormous. I just want to add one other thing.
Sure.
And that is, in 2014, President Obama dealt with something very similar to this situation. And then Vice President Biden, went down to the border, and he was very well aware from that experience the difficulty that the administration, the Obama-Biden administration, had when there was a surge, a similar kind of surge, and what the administration had to do. So I'm struck myself watching President Biden, and he has a base of knowledge from this that was searing from the Obama administration. And we're also watching on Capitol Hill, the House just passed immigration legislation, very specific immigration legislation. So this is a president who knows, this should not have been a surprise in some ways, in terms of the problems and the challenges.
Shane, about that, two pieces of legislation passed in the House yesterday to give a path to citizenship for children born in this country, agricultural workers as well. Read the tea leaves for us. Where does that go from there?
Well, I think it's going to face some challenges in the Senate. We've, I think, talked about this a couple of weeks ago when we were looking at the administration's plans to try and chart this path forward. You know, I think there are some elements of this proposal, these proposals, that might be more popular. I mean, the issue of, you know, particularly when it comes to children and young people who were brought to the United, or now maybe young adults who are brought to the United States. But going back to my earlier point, I mean, when you talk about, you know, the path to citizenship, it sounds nice and sounds bipartisan and say, okay, well, we'll have X number of years that you'll be in the country, and then you can apply for the green card and this kind of thing. You know, getting down to the level of the details is important, but also the politics. It's useful for the opposition party to have this hanging out there right now as an unresolved matter. So it's going to face an uphill climb in the Senate.
We're going to turn now to COVID-19 news. So I want to bring in someone who covers health policy. Sarah Cliff is an investigative reporter at the New York Times, where she specializes in health policy. Hey, Sarah, welcome to 1A.
Thanks for having me.
Moderna announcing this week it's going to begin testing its COVID vaccine on children under the age of 12 and on babies as young as 6 months old. Walk us through the importance of how this is going to work and the importance of this as well, sort of the unique challenges these companies face testing these drugs on children as opposed to adults.
Yes, yeah, so we've seen these drugs be incredibly successful in adults, but now you're right, David, there's this large challenge of rolling out these trials in children where they're going to be testing out different dosages. And I think the thing that is really challenging here is, you know, children are not just tiny adults. They need different care. They might need different dosages from adults, and they want to be extra careful when dealing with a vulnerable population of minors. So you might see these trials move a little slower, but I also think they're going to be quite crucial to the reopening of schools debate that we're having in parallel. I think, you know, there's a lot of parents, myself included, who are quite anxious to have children back in school. So you're going to see these two things playing out in tandem, the testing of vaccines in kids and this reopening debate that we're having.
Dr. Anthony Fauci was on Capitol Hill yesterday talking with senators about this very issue, about the prospect of getting kids back to school full time in the fall. He also talked a bit about herd immunity and the role that vaccines will play in getting us to herd immunity. this line stood out to me, Sarah, and I want to run it by you. He said, quote, "We should be careful about wedding ourselves to the concept of herd immunity." First of all, sort of what happened at this hearing, and then what is Dr. Fauci getting at there, casting a bit of doubt or skepticism on herd immunity?
Yeah. So I think, you know, there's this concept of herd immunity that if we get to a certain number of people vaccinated or immune to the disease from previous infection, that the disease will no longer be able to spread. It'll essentially not be able to have these outbreaks that we currently have. But, you know, I've talked to other epidemiologists and health experts like Dr. Fauci who really caution against, say, you know, thinking about this target that we need to hit. You know, for one, we don't actually know what that target is. You know, it may be when the pandemic started, some people were saying it was as low as 60 or 70%. We've seen figures like Dr. Fauci move it up to 80, even 90%. But I think when I've talked to experts about this particular question, they kind of think of herd immunity as a gradient. The more immunity you have in your herd, the more people you have vaccinated, the harder it is for the disease to spread. So it might be quite a while till we get to herd immunity, or till we get to a level where there can't be any outbreaks at all, you know, especially because these trials on children are running, you know, a little bit longer than the trials we've had on adults. So I think what he's doing is saying, you know, we shouldn't be waiting for this magical figure that flips a switch. We should be getting more people vaccinated and slowly reopening in tandem with the level of immunity in our herd.
Alexis Simondinger, about that, about getting the most people vaccinated that we can, this president, before he was president, had a goal of vaccinating 100 million people in the first 100 days of his administration. And we learned this week he's going to hit that goal earlier than he expected he would.
Yeah, he's hitting it today, actually. One of the comments, though, that we certainly have heard from those who are really expert like Sarah is on the data is that 100 million doses in 100 days, which would have taken him to the end of April, was actually considered to be a conservative goal in the context of how many vaccination doses were already going out under the previous administration. So there's no question that it's to be applauded that maybe 2.5 million a day are getting vaccinated. And the last I looked at, one of the vaccine trackers were up to in the United States something like close to 18% of you know, the population has gotten at least one dose. So he wants applause for this. He wants some recognition for this. And then he's trying to indicate to Americans that he has this theme that the government works and it works for you, and that he wants more people to have confidence in the government. Part of that confidence also is to try to argue to the American people who may be hesitant, and that includes some people in Congress, by the way, to get vaccinated, that look at all the millions of people who are getting this vaccine, who've accepted it, have taken various versions of it, and we're really moving ahead. They're healthy, they're doing well, they had no complications. And so he's trying to overcome some of that by talking endlessly publicly about all of these goals that the government is setting.
Sarah Cliff, Alexis mentioning a few members of Congress who haven't gotten the vaccine. I think of Senators Mike Braun, Ron Johnson, Rand Paul, and Rick Scott, who for whatever reason have not gotten these vaccines yet. What are the ramifications of that as you see it?
Yes, I mean, I think that it might be twofold. You know, one on the very micro level is it might make it a little easier for the disease to spread in Congress if you have fewer people who are vaccinated. Mm-hmm. On the more macro level, I think it's really about example setting. If people see their elected leaders not getting vaccinated, yeah, they might have reason to question the vaccine, decide that they don't want to do it themselves. You know, you've seen someone like President Biden, you know, doing this quite publicly, you know, wanting to make an example out of his own vaccination. And I think you get the counterexample when you see legislators consciously having access to the vaccine and deciding not to take it.
Electing not to take it. We'll hear more from you and our guests in a moment.
Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Joe knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult. The connection that happens between people can be very powerful, and how healing it can be to have a healthy relationship with someone.
To get matched with a counselor within 48 hours and save 10%, go to betterhelp.com/1A.
Ariel Waldman spent weeks peering into the Antarctic ice through her microscope.
It's really brimming with life. It's just that most of it is invisible to us.
Traveling through the looking glass. That's on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Let's get back to the news roundup. Well, $10 billion of President Biden's $1.9 trillion American Rescue Plan will go towards schools to ramp up screening for COVID-19. Another $2.2 billion or so that's been set aside for testing in underserved communities. But that extra support has not necessarily translated to schools committing to reopening in the fall full time. The superintendent of the San Francisco Unified School District said on Tuesday they're planning to return to in-person learning in the fall, but it seems up in the air whether that is going to be full time. Sarah Cliff, let me turn to you. That's San Francisco. How different is that conversation there than the ones other superintendents are having with teachers and administrators and unions across the country about school reopenings this fall?
I think it's really a conversation happening everywhere where you see school districts making a lot of different decisions. You've seen some that have, you know, tried to operate open through the pandemic, others that are just starting to ease into reopening. I think, you know, generally you are seeing more movement towards reopening, but this uncertainty about whether we'll have 5 day a week school in the fall for the next school year, I think that's pretty pervasive across the country. And I think it is a kind of moving target and one where this $10 billion in funding and this extra testing infrastructure, I think, will certainly play a role. One thing that has been very true throughout the pandemic is we haven't really had a national testing infrastructure. It's been very haphazard. You know, parents who need to get a test for their kid to return to school are kind of left to their own devices often to figure out how to do that. So I do think this extra funding will play into that conversation. And it is a step by the Biden administration trying to make it more likely that we do have 5 day a week school in the coming school year.
Alexis, the CDC expected to issue new COVID guidelines surrounding schools. Any indication of what might be in them, how early we might get word from the federal government about what their preference or their guidelines are?
Well, one of the things that we're anticipating seeing out of the CDC that they've already talked about is this idea that in school settings, 6 feet of social distancing may not be necessary and that 3 feet of distancing would be fine. And the guidance is expected to say that there has been no tangible evidence that there is a difference between 3 or 6 feet in the school setting. And that is supposed to, you know, allay some of the concerns that teachers and administrators have and school districts about the settings in which they're trying to adapt guidelines. And, you know, obviously some students go to schools that are private, some public, many new buildings, some old buildings, and many crowded schools. So this idea that the guidance is going to try to alleviate some of those concerns in the schools is helpful. The other element that may not be CDC guidelines, but also that the administration is touting is a federal effort to try to get more teachers vaccinated. Not all states have embrace the idea of the eligibility of teachers and administrators and even bus drivers to be vaccinated all at the same time. And so the federal government has tried to kind of be a mediator there. And I mention that because I happen to have a niece who's a math teacher, and she just got her first dose yesterday, and she's thrilled. She has to teach in a mix of virtual and mm-hmm. in-person, and that really helps teachers and parents have more confidence.
A lot of listeners writing about vaccine hesitancy and about access as well. Bill writing in, why are people still hesitant about the vaccine? It's not going to make you more likely to get the virus. Aaron writing on Facebook, we can't let vaccine refusers hold us hostage. When airlines and cruise ships and other venues start requiring proof of vaccination to buy a ticket, a lot of people will decide they need it after all. And Shane, I'm going to read an email to you from Andy. My dad lives in Bucks County, Pennsylvania. He's 82 years old, and we cannot even get him an appointment. We've registered him with his county and all local pharmacies in his area. We can't get anyone on the phone for answers or help. We were talking a bit just a moment ago about how the vaccination campaign is going. It does still seem like demand is way outstripping supply.
Totally. And because we do public health by state in this country, every state is different. You know, my father and my stepmother got vaccinated quite a while ago, and they live in rural Arkansas. My mother-in-law in New Jersey only got hers yesterday, and I have a mother in Portland who got it a month ago. It's all over the map, and here I'm in D.C. still waiting for mine. You have these stories of this kind of very uneven rollout, and I think that's really more kind of like the contours of what we're talking about. We can look nationally at these numbers and say, wow, wow, the trend is really going upward, and we're 2, sometimes 3, even maybe approaching 4 million a day, and that's great. But if it's very uneven by state, and especially by regions that tend to be harder hit, you know, that's also going to, you know, impede us as we're on this level to getting, you know, we talked about with herd immunity and trying to get back to normal, and can often be very frustrating. Why, you know, one senior citizen in one state is wondering, you know, why does my relative across the country have it and I don't? And I feel like those stories are going to be with us at least for, you know, some many more weeks to come.
Sarah Cliff, Shane talking about our federalist public health in this country. Yesterday we saw the confirmation of Javier Becerra, the former California Attorney General, former congressman, to be the next head of HHS. What does that portend? What does that tell us about how this might change in the coming weeks, having somebody new helming that organization that that does oversee healthcare in this country?
Yeah, so I think it will, having kind of confirmed leadership into HHS, will hopefully speed things up a little bit. You know, you'll have someone who can be calling the shots and directing this effort. But, you know, to the point Shane made, we really do have this federalist public health system. This is a function that we've delegated to the states. And so a lot of this is, you know, will not necessarily change with new federal leadership. It's going to be left to the states to be kind of running distribution. We do see the Biden administration taking a more active role with these large federal vaccination sites, which are starting to stand up more and more. But at the end of the day, a lot of this, you know, like Shane was saying, is going to run through the states. And I do think we'll see variability. We're seeing that right now as some states open up their vaccines to everyone. Right now, my colleagues reported we have 17 states that will make all adults eligible for vaccines before the May 1st deadline that the Biden administration has sent. And it's a bit of a game of luck, right? Whether you live in one of those 17 states or not.
Just continuing to look at the federalism of all of this, Shane, I want to ask you about these 21 Republican state attorneys general who have threatened to take legal action against the Biden administration over the latest COVID relief package, that $1.9 trillion stimulus package. What are they accusing the Biden administration of doing, or how do they say their hands are tied as a result of that landmark legislation getting through?
Well, the issue here concerns this pot of money. It's about $350 billion that the relief package set aside specifically for state and local governments, many of which have seen, you know, the significant drops in revenues and have real budget shortfalls. Not all of them do, by the way. We should note that. Some are actually doing relatively well. But what these states' attorneys generals are saying is that the law unconstitutionally prohibits them from using this money to basically finance local tax cuts. Some of them are saying, like, look, we were planning on cutting taxes even before the pandemic, and now you're saying we can't use this money to make up for revenue shortfalls that we'll realize from cutting people's taxes. And, you know, the Biden administration and Democrats in Congress said, well, we're making sure that we're putting these restrictions on here, which we think are sensible, to just make sure that this money actually goes for helping states and local governments recover from the economic pain of the pandemic rather than just financing tax cuts as a policy priority. So now we're going to see. I mean, is this really, as some have said in a letter, they said this week, they called it an unprecedented and unconstitutional limits on states' abilities to lower taxes. I suppose the courts will settle that. But it does give you a sense of how, you know, even when you're talking about something that you would think everybody would be for, which is like, you know, money to finance state and local governments, here, take this money, that these state officials are saying, not so fast. You can't dictate to us how we get to spend that money.
Alexis, this is a massive piece of legislation, and we know that the IRS, for one, is under a great deal of strain just to implement a lot of what's in that piece of legislation. Help us understand that a little bit better, if you could. There are a lot of moving pieces here, and a lot of agencies having to get up to speed very quickly to implement this law that was passed only a matter of days ago.
That's absolutely right. So whether you're in the Small Business Administration or you're at the Treasury Department or within the Treasury Department at the IRS, a massive piece of legislation like this imposes a lot of responsibilities and new requirements. It's part of the reason that the Treasury Department wanted to say quickly, look, we're on top of the dispersal of these $1,400 checks. If you're eligible, we're on top of, you know, getting this information about who you are and whether you're eligible, and then and making deposits or sending you checks or debit cards. In the IRS's case, we're watching how the idea that they are really underwater with a lot of responsibilities means that some of us are going to take advantage of an extra month to do our filing of our income taxes. The deadline got extended from April to the middle of May, and part of the reason is because the Internal Revenue Service is really deluged with responsibilities. And the Democrats in the House who were eager to work with the Senate to eke this legislation through really tried to think through with the departments and agencies whether and how they would have the capability to initiate, even though we are learning that some of this money won't go out probably for a year in some cases.
Sarah Cliff, let me ask you about that legislation, focusing on sort of the economic policy portion of it. But there's a lot in that piece of legislation to deal with some of these public health issues as well. Help us understand sort of how that's going and how that's changing the way that, yes, vaccines are being distributed, but also testing is made more robust across the country.
Yeah, so this legislation, you know, it's going to spend billions of dollars putting funding towards testing. And again, we haven't really had a national testing strategy or testing infrastructure since this pandemic began more than a year ago. It reflects the fragmented healthcare system that I've been covering, you know, for a decade, where you have hospitals doing testing, and then cities and states are also doing it, and also some clinics, but there's nothing really unified. And so I think what you're seeing is, as we get towards reopening, experts are saying, you know, it's not just about vaccination, it's about having a good testing infrastructure where we can watch the spread of the disease and kind of stop outbreaks before they start as more people are going to be out and about. I think another key part of the economic policy, and you know what Alexis was saying, you know, made me think of this, are some big subsidies that are going to be going towards the Affordable Care Act. The stimulus spends $34 billion putting more money towards the subsidies that people who purchase their own insurance receive. And again, that's a big effort. HHS is very, very busy with this, just like the IRS is busy with other functions. And it might take about a year or so for some of those benefits to reach people. But that's another big pot of money. I think one of the things that strikes me about the stimulus is that it's very multifaceted. You know, most of us are thinking about the $1,400 checks, the things that are pretty tangible. But there are so many different provisions that are all part of this $1.9 trillion package.
Shane, I want to ask you lastly just about the confirmations that we've seen this week, the president's cabinet kind of coming into fine focus here. I mentioned Javier Becerra being confirmed yesterday. Your latest piece is about William Burns, the longtime diplomat now confirmed to head the CIA. We had Deb Haaland confirmed this week as well to head the Interior Department. She self-described 35th generation New Mexican. What do you see as you look at the president's cabinet?
Well, I think that ultimately one of the stories is a story of diversity, racial, ethnic, gender diversity, which was intentional from the beginning. Just in my area where I pay the most attention to in national security, I know that the president was very keen on making sure that he tried to have a reflection of what America looks like in the upper reaches and leadership of the cabinet. And I think that if you look across it, he's probably accomplished that to a great deal. You also had the Senate confirming this week Katherine Tai as the U.S. Trade Representative, who will be the first woman of color in that job. So that was important. But it was also important to him, too, that he drew on people who had relevant experience either in the area where they were going to work or in managing, you know, big departments or agencies or big operations. So, you know, it's taken about 2 months, I guess, as these things go. Uh-huh. Yeah, maybe not the fastest and always, but nevertheless got them through with, you know, a few missteps and stumbles, some pretty, you know, divided opposition. You know, Javier Becerra and others maybe were more controversial. And then others like Bill Burns for CIA, who went through as a unanimous consent voice vote. Still a reflection of some partisan differences, but also some pretty broad bipartisan support for some of these nominees, too.
And Katherine Tai, that U.S. trade rep getting confirmed 98-0 in the Senate. Shane Harris covers national security and intelligence for The Washington Post. Alexis Simmendinger is a national correspondent for The Hill. Sarah Cliff is a health policy reporter at The New York Times. Thanks to all of you for joining us. 1A's lead audio engineer and sound designer is Jake Cherry. He gets technical assistance from Ben Privett, Mike Kidd, and Rashad Young. Aileen Humphreys is the producer and editor of 1A On Demand. Gabrielle Healy is our digital editor, and Chris Cristano is our digital producer. We're rounding up the week's top news stories. We'll be back with global headlines in a moment. You're listening to 1A.
Support for NPR comes from Newman's Own Foundation, working to nourish the common good by donating all profits from Newman's Own food products to charitable organizations that seek to make the world a better place. More information is available at newmansownfoundation.org. Support for NPR comes from Newman's Own Foundation, working to nourish the common good by donating all profits from Newman's Own food products to charitable organizations that seek to make the world a better place. More information is available at newmansownfoundation.org.
It's that time of the week when we look at the biggest stories that happened overseas. It's the News Roundup. America may be slowly reopening, but large parts of Europe are going in the opposite direction. Paris is set to go into a month-long COVID lockdown as France battles what's being called a third wave. Meanwhile, things have gone a little sideways in Anchorage between China and the new administration. Russia's president, Vladimir Putin, is said to be furious with President Biden. We'll find out why. Joining us this week, Nancy Youssef. She's a national security correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. Thrilled to welcome back Indira Lakshmanan. She's senior executive editor at National Geographic. And Paul Danahar is the Washington bureau chief for the BBC, author of the book The New Middle East, The World After the Arab Spring. Welcome to all of you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Great to be with you.
Great to be here.
It's been a roller coaster of a week for millions in Europe. Many countries there stopped using the Oxford AstraZeneca coronavirus vaccine following deaths due to blood clots in people who had received vaccinations, a move that, in truth, baffled a lot of the experts. Then on Thursday, the European Medicines Agency declared that the vaccine is safe to use. The agency's chief gave countries the green light to resume vaccinations. But then she added this.
After days of in-depth analysis of lab results, clinical reports, autopsy reports, and further information from the clinical trials, we still cannot rule out definitively a link between these cases and the vaccine.
Paul Danahar, I'll turn to you first. You're watching that roller coaster here from Washington. What happened in Europe this week?
Well, it's been a mess. And frankly, everything to do with vaccine rollout in Europe has been a bit of a mess. They began by, some of it's rooted in Brexit. Some of it's rooted in a frustration that the British didn't give them big doses of the vaccine that were being produced. Some of it's to do with the fact that the vaccine being produced in Europe was sent to the UK. So uh-huh. They began by being very sceptical about how good the vaccine was. The French talked about it shouldn't be used by people over 65. So they created this idea that it was a kind of a substandard vaccine. Then there were some very, very small cases of blood clots that happened to people who'd also had the vaccine. Now, the scientists said, well, the number of blood clots are actually no more than you'd get in the general population. But because the vaccine had been so run down publicly by many European leaders, that created a great deal of concern. And so you had all, many, many, 13 countries in the EU suspend use of the vaccine. And now, because of that, partly because of that decision, the countries across Europe are seeing a third wave, and they're not in a position to stop it because their vaccine rollout programs are well behind schedule.
Indira, let me ask you about an argument, a kind of paradoxical argument that the chair of Ireland's Immunization Committee made. She's trying to make the case that their decision to suspend the program should increase people's confidence in that vaccine. Here she is speaking to the broadcaster RTE.
Actually, guys, look at this in a way, this should increase your confidence in vaccination programs. What you want is you want us to deliver safe programs. We are taking every measure to make sure that that is what we're doing.
Indira, do you buy that? I called it kind of paradoxical there. There are a lot of folks who are worried that by taking this pause this week, it is going to, as Paul was saying, reduce people's faith in or belief in the efficacy or the safety of these vaccines.
No, but I see the argument. To have simply ignored it and not taken any action, I think would undermine public confidence in the vaccine because you would be seen to not be taking seriously, the actual events of people getting blood clots. Uh-huh. Now, while it may be true that this is no higher than the blood clots you would have seen in the general public anyway, the very fact that a correlation was made means scientifically, medically, it is important to investigate that. The fact that all of those European nations have now restarted use of the AstraZeneca vaccine, even as you said, that the health officials said, well, we can't completely rule it out. But the most important thing they said was cost-benefit analysis, that, you know, we don't think there's a link to the blood clots, and regardless of whether there's a link, more people die from COVID than are dying from blood clots in any case. And so the any kind of risks with it outweigh any kind of benefits mm-hmm. outweigh the risks. And, you know, the important thing to point out is also these rare blood disorders and clots were highest among young women, which happens to be the group in Europe where vaccine hesitancy already runs the highest. So I think it is important to take the public's concerns seriously and investigate them. They obviously, you know, will continue to do more as I don't think we've noted yet, but the United States has not yet approved the AstraZeneca vaccine. So it's still being studied.
One of our listeners, Chris, writing in, so there were 18 cases of blood clots out of 20 million vaccines administered. Of the 18 cases, I don't know how many were fatal, yet compared to 20 million vaccines, it seems like it's worth the risk to wait for another vaccine. I'm sure the mortality rate of COVID far surpasses this vaccine. Nancy, let me turn to you. This is a story about quantity and about deployment of vaccines as well. And there was a piece in Yahoo News this week that 45% of that Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine has gone unused across the European Union. Seems like a worryingly high number, especially as we look around the world, see the kind of demand or potential demand in a place like Brazil, which is really wrestling with this.
That's right. And it's worth noting only 10% of EU residents have had the vaccine. And so when a report that comes out that says of the 15 million vaccine doses that have been delivered, only half have been administered, 45% of them, really, I think, highlights the challenge about vaccine distribution. I think so many people were focused on as soon as a vaccine is created, it will lead to the end of the pandemic. But that's actually the first step because there are multiple steps in between in which the drug must be distributed, administered, and actually get into people's arms. Part of that is logistical, and part of that is sort of confidence in the vaccine itself. And so I think what this report shows is that the logistical challenge, that it's not enough to have the vaccine, that governments have to find a way to distribute them in a timely manner. And with these vaccines in particular, some of the challenges are that they require to be in certain temperatures. And so to me, the report really highlighted that we can't think about the end of the pandemic as simply producing the vaccine, but coming up with the mechanisms to actually administer them and get them into people's arms.
Paul, I'll turn to you on this next question about sort of how we return or begin to return to normalcy. Amid that news about vaccines, there's also news about vaccine passports and other mechanisms we could have that would make it easier perhaps to reopen travel across borders. What do we know of Europe's plans at this point to have something called a digital green certificate?
Yeah, well, this is the idea is that anyone who has had the virus recently, anyone who's tested negative recently, uh-huh. or has had a vaccine, would get a little bit of paper that would allow them to move around. And the hope is that this would begin to allow one of the great cherished things about the EU, the free movement of people across borders. The concern is that you'll end up with a kind of an apartheid system where those who've got the vaccine will be able to move around and those that don't won't. That will mean that big chunks of the population, particularly younger people who are less likely to get the vaccine first, will find themselves stuck where they are. So it's going to be a very difficult thing to introduce because you're going to find certain people saying, hang about, I actually need to move because of work, not to just go on holiday like, you know, many retirees may do once they get their vaccine. So it will be obviously a step towards normality, but it's going to be a really difficult one to manage. And with all the frustration in Europe anyway about the vaccine rollout and how it's all been done, you can see this being the next big bone of contention.
Nancy, there was a lot of concern early on about what this virus is going to mean across the continent of Africa and among the population there. It hasn't been as severe as many projected it would be, but we have seen several leaders of African countries die under dubious circumstances, I think you could say, with symptoms that sound related to COVID-19. I want to focus on Tanzania this week. That country's president had been a very outspoken COVID-19 denier for a long time. He passed away, and as I understand it, that's being attributed to issues with his heart. Help me understand a bit more about that story. What happened in Tanzania?
So it's actually quite fascinating because he was really one of the most outspoken critics. And to give you a sense, I mean, he said that the people should pray away coronavirus.
Come to the churches, he said.
I beg your pardon?
He said, come to the churches. He was encouraging people
to
worship together.
Or herbal remedies. At one point, he didn't allow for the counting of coronavirus cases. And so in Tanzania, there were family members having to bury their dead from coronavirus at night because this was something that wasn't acknowledged. And so he really gave fuel to COVID skeptics, much to the frustration of the World Health Organization. And he hadn't been seen from since February 27th, and his critics suggested that this was because he had suffered from coronavirus. This was someone who was going around not wearing a mask and frankly had suppressed press freedom such that it allowed room for speculation. And so on Wednesday, the Vice President Semya Hassan announced that John Magufuli had died, and the official reason given, as you noted, was heart complications. But because of all the speculation around his movement, because of his denial, because of the lack of transparency within his government that's only increased during his tenure, it's created speculation that perhaps what killed him was coronavirus. And so it's really highlighted some of the challenges that particularly in the African continent people are having with sort of having a discussion around coronavirus. And I think he was really a real public figure for the myriad of theories that people were offering for something other than the pandemic that the rest of us acknowledge.
You mentioned Brazil a moment ago. Things continue to worsen there. That's a country with a leader who has been skeptical of the problems associated with COVID-19 as well.
Yes, and also who has gotten COVID-19. Yes. Jair Bolsonaro, along with Boris Johnson, two leaders who were prominently skeptical of some of the restrictions, both did contract coronavirus, as of course our own former president Donald Trump. Fortunately, none of them died from it. But it is going to be interesting to continue to watch those countries in which leaders have not taken it seriously. From a public policy point of view, how does it affect the greater population as well as the leadership?
And it seems America's longest war is likely to run even longer. There's a May 1st deadline looming. That date was set by the former president, Donald Trump, who agreed to pull U.S. troops out of Afghanistan if the Taliban were to commit to peace talks. Well, here's what the current president told ABC News this week.
It is tough because, look, the failure to have an orderly transition from the Trump presidency to my presidency, which usually takes place from election day to the time you're sworn in, has cost me time and consequences.
Nancy Youssef, I'll start with you. Did you hear that as an attempt to dodge this question? This issue of troop withdrawal is something that stymied this president, the one before him, the one before that.
I think from where I sit, I heard the sort of first indication that the idea of all U.S. troops being out by May 1st was very unlikely. And it was the first time we'd had that acknowledgement. There'd been whispers in Washington about it because there'd been a lack of progress. And here was a signal, it's probably not going to happen. So the question becomes, then what? Because if you're the Taliban, arguably there's no incentive to enter another deal. Could this lead to increased attacks against U.S. troops because the Taliban is restrained from that with the expectation that the U.S. leave? And so I think what you heard the president really saying is there are no good options. If one stays in Afghanistan, it threatens an end to the war there. If the U.S. leaves and its allies leave with it, then you could have a situation where the country collapses, where the Taliban's back in control and the U.S.-backed Afghan government there falls apart, and a lot of the progress and efforts there dissipate. And so what I heard was a spelling out of not very good options, but at least for the foreseeable future, the prospect of the U.S. leaving and its allies leaving in 30-some days is now unlikely.
Among those advising not leaving is General John Allen, the former commander of NATO and U.S. forces in Afghanistan, now the president of the Brookings Institution here in D.C. He thinks withdrawing troops now would be a massive mistake. Here he is on CNN.
By leaving on 1 May, we abandon the women, we abandon the Afghan people who are struggling ultimately to achieve modernity and a place in the world that is their right and is possible.
Paul, do you agree with Nancy? It seems like there are no good options here at this point.
Yeah, but the May 1st deadline was a particularly silly idea, frankly, because spring is what's called the beginning of the fighting season in Afghanistan. Over the winter, all the sort of paths and roads and cities are cut off by the snow and the bad weather. So the fighting normally stops. So if you're going to have a period where you pull your troops out, it's probably better to do it at the beginning of winter. So there's a kind of 4 or 5 month period where people can't fight. If you pull your troops out at the beginning of what's known, as I say, as the fighting season, you then run the risk of a complete security collapse and an overrun. So I think the original deadline was more about politics than the reality of trying to manage a security situation on the ground in Afghanistan. And I suspect that's what's driving a lot of the concern.
Indira, what about the legitimacy of the talks, the productivity of the talks? They have been happening. I believe they've been happening in Doha, among other places. Where do they stand? Has there been any tangible progress among the two sides talking?
Look, I think it's really hard to call talks legitimate that have left out the Afghan government. We can't really call these peace talks. These are peace talks that the Trump administration agreed to have on a bilateral basis with the Taliban, leaving out the Afghan government and thereby the Afghan people represented by Ashraf Ghani. And to have agreed to a pullout based on that seems really tenuous and unwise at best. But what I'd like to do is sort of take a 20,000 foot view of this whole thing, which is let's think about where we were 20 years ago. I happened to be one of the reporters who went into Afghanistan right at the time of the fall of the Taliban when the first U.S. troops went in. And so let's think about where we were then versus where we are now. This is 20 years later. Over the course of those 20 years, some 800,000 U.S. troops have cycled in and out of the country. At its height, we had 100,000 troops there. But let's not forget that in 2014, the U.S. fighting combat mission ended. Ever since then, we have been in a different role, in a counterterrorism role. And the 2,500 to 3,500 U.S. troops that remain in the country did not do direct fighting with the Taliban. They advise their Afghan partners, they do training, and they do counterterrorism. And they support the 8,000-some NATO troops who are in there who rely on us for logistics and security support. So if were we to pull out all of our troops, we would not only be abandoning the Afghan people, we would also be abandoning our NATO allies who were there because of the push that we made 20 years ago after the World Trade Center and Pentagon bombings, the four planes, let's not forget, which was all directed by Al-Qaeda, which was taking refuge thanks to the Taliban in Afghanistan. So I think we need to think about this as sort of an insurance policy. What does it cost the U.S.? It costs $5 billion annually for this small U.S. force in Afghanistan. And we have to think about, is it worth it as an insurance policy to prevent another 9/11 style attack? I think most Americans would say it is. For Biden himself, this is difficult because he has always been on the side. When he was vice president for 8 years, he has always wanted a small counterterrorism presence. But that's not the same as saying, let's take out entirely. I think it's very likely that if the U.S. completely withdrew, which would force NATO withdraw, that the Afghan government would be overrun and it would be run by the Taliban. So, you know, this is a difficult question, if not one of the most important foreign policy challenges facing the Biden administration today.
Some long perspective there on the long war. And Nancy, Indira, they're mentioning the number of troops in Afghanistan. This has been something unknown, relatively unknown here until recent days. You had the New York Times reporting this week on the actual number of U.S. troops who are in Afghanistan or believed to be in Afghanistan.
I'm so glad you brought it up, because this has been a longstanding issue with the United States military, not only in Afghanistan, but around the world. The official number of U.S. troops is 2,500. The New York Times reporting showed that the more realistic number is 3,500, and that's a big difference. One of the things that the military has done has been reticent to sort of be transparent about its numbers. And so there are little games that are played, frankly. They'll put people on things called temporary duty, which is that they only serve for, say, 90 uh-huh. days, and therefore they're not counted in the number. Special operators aren't counted. And so this is sort of a holdover, and it's been around since the Vietnam War, when numbers were used as a way to measure success or failure in the war. And because of it, throughout the world, I don't think we have the most accurate accounting of how many troops are deployed. Even when numbers are presented, that's rarely the complete number. And so I think it gives you a sense of the size of the footprint, and that we have to think about these numbers as fluid. That the Department of Defense's argument is that there is no static number, that troops are moving in and out. But I think it's fair to say that there are efforts to keep those numbers low, because war is an extension of politics, and the number of troops there has political implications for the U.S. and for allies as well.
Paul Danahar, I'm going to continue pulling from this interview that the president did with George Stephanopoulos of ABC News. This week, Russia's ambassador to Washington was ordered back to Moscow. That came just hours after an exchange in that interview. Let's take a listen.
Look, most important thing dealing with foreign leaders in my experience, and I've dealt with an awful lot of them over my career, is just know the other guy.
So you know Vladimir Putin. You think he's a killer?
Mm-hmm. I do.
So what price must he pay?
The price he's going to pay, well, you'll see shortly.
Paul, the U.S. president, they're calling the Russian president a killer, or at least agreeing with George Stephanopoulos' characterization thereof. Help us understand the significance of that as you look at the relationship so much as there is one now between these two countries.
Yeah, I can't imagine anyone's going to be pulling out a big reset button and handing it over to the Russians in the near future. I think what we saw during the Trump administration was a steady deterioration in relations, even though Trump seemed to have gone out of his way to get on with Putin. And I think America now recognizes that they need to basically reset things from their point of view, be tough with Russia, because they know that Russia basically is doing everything that they can to destabilize America and American power and the projection of American power around the world, and even, you know, trying to undermine American democracy, which is what we've seen over the last couple of elections. So I think what Biden is basically saying is, you can forget what was going on with Trump. There's a new guy in town, and I'm not going to sit here and be suckered like the last president was. Expect some tough action. And I think we're going to see, I think we're going to see a very, very frosty relationship between America and Russia. We're going to see a very frosty relationship between America and China. And, you know, Biden's been around a long time. He's a president that's met all these people before, so he's not going to be hoodwinked. They know what they're getting. I think we're in for a bit of a bumpy ride.
Indira, I'll turn to you on this point as well. President Putin asked about that comment. He shrugged it off. He said he only wished the president of the United States good health, as he put it. How does it change how he operates within his country?
Yeah, I don't think it changes how Vladimir Putin operates. I thought his response was pretty interesting, because on the one hand, he said, in childhood, when we argue with each other, he who calls names is called that himself, and basically said something about, you know, President Biden is looking in the mirror. It was kind of the Russian equivalent of I'm rubber, you're glue. Whatever you say bounces off me and sticks to you. Then he turned from that kind of language to saying, I wish you good health. Which is menacing from someone whose government has been linked, you know, to the untimely demise of various critics in his own country and Russians abroad. You know, it's not an auspicious start for the relationship, but as Paul said, nor is it a moment for having some great reset. I think that, you know, Putin enjoyed a bit of a honeymoon during, in some ways, in the 4 years of the Trump administration, in which, you know, Donald Trump certainly said many flattering things about Vladimir Putin. I don't think he could have expected that from Joe Biden. What's really important is what's happening going forward. The U.S. intelligence community said this past Tuesday that the Russian government meddled in the 2020 election, as it had in the 2016 election, by denigrating Joe Biden and supporting, that's in quote marks from the U.S. intel report, Trump. And the Biden administration is expected to announce sanctions related to election interference as soon as next week. So, you know, I think there's much more to come on this story about the road of U.S.-Russian relations, which are troubled.
Turn now to Asia. North Korea has been pretty quiet as of late. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin met with their South Korean counterparts on Wednesday, stressing that North Korea's nuclear ambitions were a priority. But so far, outreach from the new administration has been rebuffed, the White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki confirming earlier reports that nothing has come of attempts to start a fresh dialogue with Pyongyang. She says they'll continue to try to find a peaceful path forward.
Our goal is to reduce the risk of escalation. Diplomacy continues to remain our first priority. I think you can all anticipate that there will be a continued expansion of engagement with partners and allies in the region, and this will, of course, be a topic of discussion.
North Korea's first comments directed at the Biden administration came on Tuesday. Kim Jong-un's sister warned the U.S. to refrain from causing a stink if it wants to, quote, sleep in peace for the next 4 years. Paul Danahar, sounds like a script from a bad movie about the mafia, but how big a priority is this for the Biden administration? You look at where the secretaries of defense and state went on their first trip overseas.
It is important, and I think the what they recognize from the North Koreans is the North Koreans don't like being ignored, and they're the sort of country that if you do ignore them, they will do something out of the ordinary. They may fire off missiles. missiles, or they may threaten the South Korean or Japan. So I think what this is two things. One is that they do need to go and see Japan and South Korea, because both of them felt much less protected under the Trump administration. And secondly, they need to show that North Korea, yes, you're on our radar. We are going to talk to you. We are going to take you seriously, but we are not going to let you get a free pass in the way that they felt that, again, Donald Trump gave them. So it is important. But North Korea, you have to make them think that you matter to them. Otherwise, they will try and do something to force themselves onto your radar. And I think that's what we're seeing this week.
Nancy Yusuf, Paul, they're talking about sort of the effusion or suffusion of ego in diplomacy. And I wonder how the prospects for a diplomatic relationship have changed as a result of what we saw during the last administration, the past president making personal entreaties to the leader of North Korea.
Well, it's interesting because one of the things we haven't seen is a missile test. You usually saw that at when a president was inaugurated, and so there was some change in that. But in terms of fundamentals, those didn't change. And I think a critic would say that the United States gave a lot of legitimacy to North Korea and didn't get much in return in terms of what happened over the past 4 years. But that said, we haven't seen missile tests at the rate that we did at the beginning of the Trump administration. And so I think one thing to add, by the way, as we think about the comments from Kim Jong-un's sister, is that this was on the week that the United States and South Korea were conducting tabletop exercises. Remember that the North Koreans have repeatedly called such exercises hostile, whereas the South Koreans have said they were defensive. Donald Trump had suspended the sort of more aggressive overt exercises under his administration, and I think part of those comments were timed around those in addition to the visit. To me, the big takeaway from these comments is that Pyongyang is watching and listening what is happening around the peninsula, even if it's not directly willing to engage in talks. And I think it was signaling that it is engaged, and that sort of setting the stage potentially for missile tests down the road if it doesn't like the way things are progressing.
Indira, what should we make, if anything, of who's delivering these comments, of the fact that Kim Jong-un's sister is the one making these threats or weighing in on the sort of temperature of diplomacy or prospects for diplomacy right now?
Well, Kim Yo-jong has taken the role of being an attack dog for her older brother. She's a very close and powerful ally of his. As we know, you can't count on permanent loyalty from the leader, considering that, you know, he did have his uncle, who had been like a regent, directing him executed at one point. But it is, you know, she's acting as sort of a spokesperson for her brother. And as Nancy said, you know, look, the U.S.-North Korean relations have not been good. And in 2017, the North tested long-range missiles that were capable of hitting American cities. The Trump administration, you know, had a war of words with Kim Jong-un, but then the tensions were eased as President Trump, you know, wrote letters and said he had this love affair with Kim Jong-un. We haven't really solved the problem, and it's going to be it's a tough one that many presidents have tried and not gotten very far with. So I'm not confident how much that situation is going to change.
Nancy, I want to look to Anchorage right now, if we could. The first high-level talks between the U.S. and China since President Biden took office are underway in Alaska. Both countries gathered in the Hotel Captain Cook for a dialogue. And I know you've traveled to these, seen these before. They're formal affairs. The U.S. delivered a statement. The Chinese delivered a statement. Customarily, the media is then asked to leave. As that was happening, there were kind of rebuttal arguments that were made in front of the media. The media was beckoned back. What's going on, and what's the status of the dialogue that's taking place in Alaska this week?
I mean, it was quite dramatic. These, both China and frankly, the U.S. are quite have quite orchestrated messages. This is almost pro forma, these sort of introductory remarks in front of the cameras before the discussions begin. And so it starts out normally until but the U.S. is quite aggressive, and it says it has deep concerns about China's treatment of Uyghurs, about its actions in Hong Kong, around Taiwan, its cyber attacks, and the Chinese respond and essentially say that the United States is not in the position to be lecturing about democracy, giving it its own problems. This goes back and forth. The cameras start to go, they come back. One ordered by the U.S., one's ordered by their Chinese counterparts. This goes on for an hour. And so it just was such a public, overt display of the tensions between the two countries, the degree and the scope of things that they have to work on. And I should note, these are diplomats who know each other. These are not strangers. And so the U.S. position afterwards was that China was grandstanding on behalf of its, or before its president, and that the talks became substantive after the cameras left. But, you know, for the Chinese to be calling the U.S. condescending and the U.S. to be trading barbs at something that should have been pro forma, I think, was just such an unexpected display of that hostility that I think everybody knew it. But the fact that they chose both sides to sort of showcase it, I think, speaks to the tensions and also to the feeling from the Chinese that they are to be treated as a global power. And I think one could argue one reason they were doing this was to put a fine point, to make that point aggressively, that we are not to be treated as a second-tier country. We are a global power, and we are to be treated as such.
Paul Danahar, what's the best case that comes out of this? For a long time, there were these kind of strategic and economic dialogues that took place every 2 years. There were formal talks between the two countries. After these 2 days of meetings in Alaska, what does each side want to happen?
I imagine they don't want things to get any worse than they already have. But I think what we're seeing here is really quite remarkable. And you would not have seen the Chinese delegation act like this pre-Xi Jinping. The Chinese, that's not how they do diplomacy. They would normally kind of produce a very kind of stilted diplomatic response that didn't make much sense to everybody else in the world, but would need to be, you know, passed via Chinese experts to try and work out what they actually meant. That's all gone. Under Xi Jinping, they are very robust, very strident. And as Nancy was saying, they want everyone to know that they're the new kid on the block. So I think what they'll hope to get from this is that it doesn't get any worse and that they can incrementally build things up. But this is going to be a really, really difficult relationship for America, because China simply doesn't accept that America is the preeminent power around the world. China wants to join America right at the top and then overtake. And that's going to be a difficult thing for the Biden administration to manage.
Indira, the world over, watching Atlanta with sorrow and alarm after what happened there, there's also a lot of sorrow and alarm after what happened in London to a young woman, Sarah Everard, a 33-year-old who was murdered after disappearing on her walk home. A police officer has been charged with her murder. Just an appalling story. Help us understand what happened and understand the resonance of this, as I say, globally.
Right. Well, it's brought into the spotlight the violence against women that happens every day in every country. The UK is certainly not unique in this, but it's especially horrifying because this young woman allegedly was murdered by a serving police officer who, by the way, had been reported for indecent exposure at a fast food restaurant and was not arrested and dealt with. And so the police closed in on him, by the way, extremely quickly. We don't know all the details of how they were able to find him so quickly, but they clearly had him on some sort of a watch list or suspect list. So the question is, would she have been alive if appropriate action had been taken earlier? I think that the Sarah Everard case also, you know, has set off a movement in the UK where police in the UK and Wales are now apparently going to record misogyny, hatred of women, as a hate crime on an experimental basis starting this fall, which would be really interesting. It's something activists have been calling for a long time. The problem has been that women in the UK and, again, around the world often do not report sexual harassment and sexual crimes. UN Women UK published a report saying that 95% of all women in the UK did not report their experience of sexual harassment. And, you know, if these figures are true across the world, it's a really big problem. We also know that minority women in Britain, it's black women and women of mixed ethnicities are more likely to experience sexual assault. So it's a global problem. The Sarah Everard case just brought it into the headlines. But it's been, you know, there have been protests in Australia as well, with women in Australia's parliament claiming that they also have been sexually harassed by colleagues. So it's brought a very ugly ongoing problem to the surface. And, you know, I'm hopeful that something will be done about it this time with these changes in the misogyny hate as a hate crime.
And Jerry mentions what's been going on in Australia. Let's take a listen to one of those protests. Tens of thousands of Australians gathering across that country to protest violence against women as well.
I'm 62. We're still doing this. We're still talking about the same things. And the men are choosing not to listen.
It's been so discouraging reading the news and how much has been covered up. So to see this huge swell of all people coming together to say that enough is enough is encouraging.
Those rallies, protests against misogyny and sexual abuse sparked by separate rape allegations brought against the country's attorney general and a government staffer, as Indira mentioned. Nancy, we're seeing all of this, and I wonder sort of how this moment seems to you. Does it seem pivotal that things are beginning to change as a result of these tragedies?
Yeah, I'll start with the case out of the UK. I think for me personally, and I think for a lot of women, one of the things that resonated, in addition to the points Indira mentioned, is, you know, she did everything that everyone has been told, every woman have been told you're supposed to do to avoid being attacked. She left at a reasonable hour. She was wearing bright colored clothing. She walked a longer route to be on brightly lit streets. She was on the phone with someone as she was walking as a safety precaution. And not only did it not work, her attacker is that who's been charged is a police officer. And subsequently, during those protests, you saw police officers arresting women for violating COVID, being handled and restrained, the very thing that they were protesting against. And so I think for a lot of women, this moment feels different because women are speaking out in a way that they didn't 1, 2, or 3 years ago. But because these cases are emblematic of all the things that women have been told they need to do to prevent sexual harassment and assault, people are coming forward and saying, it's not working. These problems are still here, and that it is responsibility of government to do something overtly. I think the biggest difference that I saw personally between the UK and Australia is you get a sense of real distrust of the government in the UK to do something about these issues. Whereas in Australia, this call for legislative change said to me that there's at least more optimism there that there can be a legislative action towards solutions.
Paul, we continue to look at protests around the world. I want to look at Haiti in particular. We saw over the weekend the hashtag Free Haiti going viral. Activists in that country and around the world, including Grammy winner Cardi B, tweeting in opposition to the Haitian president, who insists his presidency should last another year. Many Haitians demanding his resignation, insisting his term should have ended back in February.
Whatever takes sides in a constitutional dispute, it would be more helpful to listen to and offer solidarity with the Haitian people, who no longer recognize Jovenel Moïse as their president. Corrupt, incompetent, and authoritarian officials should never be allowed to stay in power beyond their term in the name of democracy.
That was one Haitian activist, Emmanuela Douillon, speaking at a U.S. congressional hearing last Friday. Paul, many people in Haiti fed up with their president. What has the Biden administration said? What's the Biden presidency stand to do with regard to Haiti and this situation there?
Well, it's a difficult situation for them because it's really, really unclear who should be president now, because the constitution is a bit vague over how it all works. So because he won the first round of elections in October, but then there was some dispute over whether or not whether there was voter fraud, there was a runoff, and that got pushed back. So the State Department is basically said, you know, we want there to be peace. We recognize there are problems there. But they're not kind of clearly saying he's got to go or he's got to stay. What they're calling for are kind of reconciliation and for people not to, you know, basically move towards violence. Because as we know, Haiti has had a lot of problems over the years. So I really don't think America has a simple solution for this one, because it's really, really difficult. It kind of depends on who do you decide that you're going to support on all of this. And, you know, they're under pressure to drop their support
For the president, it's difficult to see which way they're going to jump at the moment.
And Indira, let me pick things up from there. Members of Congress on both sides of the aisle calling on the Biden administration to provide temporary protected status for Haitians who are living here in America. At least 900 of them were deported by ICE in February. This is all part of a challenge the president faces with regard to immigration. Yes, this is a domestic issue of policy and politics, a humanitarian issue as well. There is an impulse to, a desire for this administration to focus at least some of its attention on what's happening in the countries from which these migrants are coming.
Yes, you're absolutely right, because essentially it's a pipeline problem, to put it crudely, that if things were better in the countries from which people are feeling the need to escape, then they wouldn't feel the need to migrate to the U.S. I mean, ultimately, nobody wants to leave their homeland. If things are safe and there are economic prospects and, you know, physical safety in one's country, why would you want to leave? So this is something. I mean, you mentioned the temporary protective status for Haitians, and one thing that has been for many, many years, for 20 years or more, a tension in U.S. policy has been, you know, the concern that Haitians were treated differently, for example, than Cubans, that Cubans, you know, this wet foot, dry foot policy, and that Cubans were allowed in a way that Haitians were not. You know, there had been a period when the migration policy was sort of ironed out a little bit, but part of the reason that the administration, both the Trump administration and now the Biden administration, have been backing President Moïse is with the hope that there could be some safety and stability in the country, and to try to calm things down. But it was very interesting to see in a congressional hearing this week that not only members of Haitian civil society, but also a former U.S. ambassador to Haiti testified that elections will not be credible, because gang violence is rising and because the plans by President Moïse for this referendum and presidential elections beyond are not credible in their view. So it's going to be a really delicate dance what the administration does to try to hold the Moïse administration's feet to the fire while maintaining stability and trying to help democracy there.
For you, Paul, I noted that Uber has agreed to reclassify its UK drivers as workers to fall partly in line with a recent court ruling. And that decision means the company's 70,000 UK drivers will for the first time be entitled to holiday pay and to enroll in a workplace pension scheme. Draw the contrast for us. It seems stark between what's happened here in the United States and what's happened in the UK, where so many Uber drivers are operating as contractors.
Yeah, I mean, this is the end of a 5-year legal battle that Uber had in the UK. It went all the way up to the UK Supreme Court, and the UK Supreme Court said they are workers and they're entitled to minimum legal holiday and pension rights. And what Uber said is that they will provide a floor in terms of, this is the kind of minimum amount that they will give people. It's very different. As in most parts of America, they are still considered to be self-employed drivers, and they get none of these benefits. So it is quite a big stark contrast.
Paul Danaher, thank you very much. Washington Bureau Chief for the BBC, the author of the book The New Middle East, The World After the Arab Spring, also joined today by Indira Lakshmanan, Senior Executive Editor at National Geographic, and Nancy Youssef, National Security Correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. Nancy and Indira, thank you both very much as well. 1A's managing producer is Paige Osborne. Our new senior producer is Jonklin Hill. Welcome, JQ. Jake Cherry is our sound designer and engineer. And Barb Anguiano produces our podcast. This program comes to you from WAMU, which is part of American University in Washington. It's distributed by NPR. I'm David Gura. This is 1A.